the County Public Defender's Office, and I represent Mr. Jerome Brown in this matter. We've identified numerous issues on appeal that we think warrant reversal, including issues that impact fundamental constitutional rights, including the Fourth Amendment right to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures, and two aspects of the Sixth Amendment, the right to confrontation and the right to self-representation. I'd like to start with Mr. Brown's request for self-representation because I think, as a logical matter, if that's resolved in my favor, the other issues aren't as important. So we have a situation where Mr. Brown, on the first day of trial, if voir dire is considered the beginning of trial, I know I indicated in my brief that trial technically begins once the jury's impaneled and sworn, but, assuming for the sake of argument that voir dire is considered like the start of trial for purposes of a timeliness request for self-representation, Mr. Brown made his request on the first day of trial. That request was not ruled on. It was delayed until the next day. So to the extent that this dragged out into a second day, I think that that is not necessarily Mr. Brown's fault, and it shouldn't, that aspect of this should not be held against him in a timeliness analysis. But the court ultimately denied his request for a couple of reasons. One, she said he was equivocal because he had made two prior motions. One was, it was the motion for someone who, was invested in his defense, and he didn't realize there's no such thing as co-representation when you're representing yourself. The other was a motion to appoint a federal public defender who had previously worked with Mr. Brown, but he withdrew that motion, so that was never even ruled on. Equivocation, the Meeks Court, the Ninth Circuit, this court has not explicitly defined equivocation in this context. It has in other contexts. But, looking at the Ninth Circuit, the Meeks case, they talk about equivocation in the sense of, would the defendant be able to turn around and argue, I was denied my right to counsel? So when I think of equivocation, I think what's commonly understood is sort of, I kind of want to represent myself. Well, maybe I don't. Well, I really do. Well, I don't know. What do you think, Judge? Like, is this a good idea? Like, that's equivocation. The mere fact that he filed two motions, which sort of highlighted concerns he was having with counsel, is completely immaterial. And in fact, Adams, in the Ninth Circuit case, this court endorsed in Gallego, basically said a conditional request is not equivocal. So I see those two as more of conditional requests, although not explicitly. Appoint Jason Carr from the federal public defender or else. That's not what he said, but to the extent those motions raised issues he was having with counsel and he was seeking some sort of to alter the arrangement, I see that more as a conditional. So there was no equivocation here. The closest would be when he said, I'm not trying to go to trial without representation, but I do think the state overemphasizes what that actually meant. As I indicated, that's just Mr. Brown acknowledging the fact that, in a criminal trial, it's probably better to have an attorney. But, he also has a fundamental right to represent himself. And the reasons behind it are not really important at all. Like, you don't have to justify it. Now, if he was requesting an alternate counsel, like, please appoint me someone, sure. This court's case law is very clear that that is a important avenue of what the court should look at. But in this case, he's asking to represent himself. That's a fundamental right. And it doesn't. So the court engaged in this, what problems are you? He could have said, I don't have no problems. I like the guy. He's a great guy. I think he's a fantastic attorney. You know what? I just want to represent myself. And I think that ends sort of the inquiry and you start the Feretta canvas at that point. And I think this court recognized in Miles, which is a pretty recent case, the importance of let's do the canvas. And then after through the canvas, you might glean more information about how sincere their request is or so forth. So I think equivocation is the court completely abused its discretion if to the extent it relied on that. Also disruption. I mean, the record is just barren of any indication that he was disruptive. He was exceedingly polite to everyone. Always addressed the court formally. Yes, ma'am, your honor. He was not rude to the prosecutors. He was not rude. He wasn't even rude to his attorney who he had issues with. He was very deferential and polite to him. He never made outbursts in court. There was one incident not off the record, but outside the presence of the jury where he did get a little emotional. But that there was a back and forth between the court and Mr. Brown. That was not an unprompted outburst. The court was pressing him and asking him questions, and he was responding, truthfully, and he got a little worked up. But again, facing life in prison, I think, would make anyone emotional.
Hi, Mr. Waters, can I turn your attention briefly to a couple questions I have? One, why was Brown in custody in North Carolina, and where's the warrant?
So my understanding is there was a warrant issued in Las Vegas, an arrest warrant, in November of 2019. It's unclear from the record, but my understanding is he was in custody on other, and the state says in their brief that he was in custody on other things in North Carolina. I think what happened was he was probably pulled over. The warrant popped up. Okay, we're going to hold him for Nevada.
But we don't know, right? That's not the record.
Well, but that's the arrest warrant. There was an arrest warrant out of Nevada, then there was a separate issue of a search warrant. So the arrest warrant goes into NCIC, and presumably when they stop him, they see it and they're like, oh, we got to hold this guy because Nevada wants us to extradite him. The other issue is a search warrant, and that's different, I think, and more important than why he was in custody in North Carolina. North Carolina law, if you wanted me to discuss the warrant, is very clear. An officer has to have jurisdiction to execute the warrant. The reason why the warrant is the record, I don't know. We weren't the trial attorney. This was Mr. Phillips from Mr. Mueller's office. I don't know why, and I don't know why the state never made it part of the record, but whatever. But the point is, I don't think it needs to be, because at least at this stage, I don't care if there's probable cause in the warrant itself. I don't care. Totally unimportant to me. Maybe on remand, that's worth exploring. But for the purposes of execution, which this court recognized in Smithart is reviewable on appeal, notwithstanding that there was no motion to suppress in the district court, for the purposes of execution, that's what we're talking about here. And so the question becomes, does the North Carolina magistrate, or more importantly, the officer, have authority to execute the warrant under North Carolina law? And we contend that they do not. And the case law for North Carolina is very clear. The statutory law for North Carolina is very clear. Other states, that might be different. But North Carolina, where he was physically present, that officer, Kotcher, did not have the jurisdictional authority to execute a warrant, even if the warrant may have been valid.
What about the arrest warrant?
Well, the arrest warrant, obviously those are different.
Right, but did they have authority to execute the arrest warrant?
Well, I think if there's a valid warrant in NCIC, and you're arrested on something else in some other state, I think that, we have extradition agreements with other states and so forth. So Nevada's saying we want this guy because he's facing, a warrant for his arrest in Nevada. Then, you comply under whatever the extradition laws are. He can contest it. You can get a governor's warrant and so forth. So I think that's just a little different because we're talking about arrest where you're not. It's go to Nevada and face the charges, see what happens, versus we're going to basically forcibly extract the most essential aspect of your body, which is your DNA. And I think that courts have routinely recognized the significance of that and why warrants are required and so forth. And I just think under North Carolina law, and they have the right, North Carolina has the right to determine the parameters of their search warrant law. They say that Kotcher didn't have jurisdiction. I hope that answered your question.
Without knowing what the search warrant says, do we know whether they exceeded their authority under North Carolina law?
Well, we know the search warrant said you can procure his buckle swab. I mean, I'm assuming we don't have it in front of us, but I mean, what else would it say? It wouldn't say get his hair, because at trial the testimony was we have to go buckle swab. But again, it's immaterial for purposes of my argument, because again, I'm assuming that they had probable cause. I'm assuming that it said, get his DNA through buckle swab. But the problem is, under North Carolina law, the Kotcher did not have the authority to execute it. And that's a problem. I want to just come back to Ferretta real quick, because I think timeliness is hugely important, because I think that's probably the district court's best argument for, I guess, why they could deny his request. I've only got like 8 seconds. I just want to say that Lyons, which is the one of the big cases in Nevada regarding timeliness, I believe if you look at Guarina, that Lyons has been abrogated a little bit. That's my opinion, because Guarina, I believe, sort of broadened the right to request self-representation. And then in Guarina, they talk about timeliness in the context of, look, if it's not going to require continuance, it should be probably be deemed timely as long as you can pass the FREDA canvas. Guarina is 2018. Lyons was 1990. Windham, which Lyons relies upon for sort of the test for when the request, the discretion the judge has to deny the request, was from 1977. FREDA itself was 75. I think Windham was sort of grappling with, well, FREDA said you have the right to represent yourself as long as it's prior to trial. We need to like sort of dig into what happens when it's closer to trial. So they're really playing around with this idea. This U.S. Supreme Court has never weighed in on this. So I think states are free to sort of expand the right. And I think in Guarina, this court did. And it said, look, if he doesn't need a continuance, which Mr. Brown was adamant, no, I can go forward. It's a timely request. I've got 3 minutes, 53 seconds. I'd like to reserve that. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Whenever you're ready, counsel.
Thank you, Justice. Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Julia Barker, and I represent the Clark County District Attorney. Today, we're respectfully requesting that you affirm the judgment of conviction for two counts of sexual assault regarding Jerome Brown. I'd like to first respond to appellant's arguments, their first argument raised in their brief, and address some of the questions, Justice, I know you had regarding whether or not the warrant for appellant's buckle was appropriate and whether or not this is actually a matter sufficient for constitutional review. Appellant's argument is attempting to frame this, their entire claim, as one that is based on constitutional grounds. However, it's a challenge to the jurisdiction of a warrant. And in making that argument, it's grounded in a fundamental misapprehension of North Carolina law. When you look at both appellant's opening brief and their reply brief, they talk about specifically their opening brief, page 16, and their reply brief, page 6. Brown does not allege that the warrant failed to establish probable cause to procure his DNA. Rather, Brown's claim is Coker lacked jurisdictional authority to execute the warrant. That's not a constitutional claim. They're relying in their brief on Smithart. And when you look at Smithart, they're challenging there how the search of a cabin was actually executed. Here, appellant's not challenging how the buckle was procured, how the swabs went into appellant's mouth. They're challenging the jurisdiction. And in doing so, they point this court to North Carolina statute and the North Carolina case law, the case law specifically being State v. Ricks. And when they do that, they misstate what State v. Ricks says. North Carolina statute says that a law enforcement agent may act within his territorial jurisdiction. And State v. Ricks is not talking about a law enforcement officer's territorial jurisdiction to investigate a crime. It's talking about whether or not a court, the North Carolina court, specifically has their jurisdiction to oversee the prosecution for a murder case. The question in State v. Ricks was whether or not there was sufficient evidence of a murder having occurred in North Carolina versus South Carolina. And the court there held there was sufficient evidence for a court to oversee the prosecution of a case. It doesn't make any reference, any comment about a law enforcement officer's authority to act within their territorial jurisdiction. And just like Justice Siglich pointed out, there was a valid arrest warrant that North Carolina officers, that North Carolina detectives, when they stopped Mr. Brown, when they stopped the appellant, saw and they took him into custody. That's why he was in custody, was on that arrest warrant.
Yeah, the record's a little thin on why he was in custody and what the warrants are.
Exactly. And that kind of goes to the state's other point of this issue has not been appropriately, the record is deficient in allowing for appellate review, because the arrest warrant's not in the record, the warrant for the buckle is not in the record. And had it been, that's a different conversation that we could have. But when you look at, because this entire argument in appellant's first point is grounded in what testimony came out from Detective Coker at the preliminary hearing, not trial. There was nothing briefed in front of the district court. There was nothing argued in front of the district court, and there was no witness testimony that came out about this issue at the district court. And without that information, the record is not, even if this court decides it's appropriate for the first time on review, under Wilkins v. State, it's clear that the record has to have been sufficiently made for review, and it simply just hasn't been here. When you look at the facts that are present, the warrant is valid. The warrant, and defense counsel appellant concedes that there was valid PC. And the officer, Detective Coker, was acting within his territorial jurisdiction. He stops Mr. Brown. He speaks to Mr. Brown. He reads Mr. Brown his Miranda rights. Mr. Brown agrees to talk. He asks him some questions, confirming he was in Las Vegas the years the two sexual assaults happened. He confirms that Mr. Brown doesn't know either one of these women. And then when the concept of DNA comes up, when the concept of, well, I need a buckle comes up, that's when this issue happens. That's when the warrant occurs. But moreover, once Detective Coker started talking about the warrant and explaining the buckle, the appellant consented to the buckle. He said that in front of the trial court, and that information came out at the preliminary hearing. So not only did Detective Coker and Fayetteville have appropriate territorial jurisdiction because the appellant was in North Carolina Metro, the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department, Detective Tooley could not have just gone out to Fayetteville and procured the buckle himself, because that is in violation of North Carolina law, because that's not within Detective Tooley's territorial jurisdiction. The only person that could have executed that warrant was a detective within Fayetteville's police department, and that's Detective Coker. Moving next to their point regarding defendant's request for self-representation, the state's position is one that the law and the standard is clear. The request for self-representation must be timely, it must be unequivocal, and the court needs to consider whether or not the defendant would be disruptive at trial. First, it wasn't timely. Whether or not this request was made the first day of jury selection, the second day of jury selection, and whether or not the district court pushed it off to the second day of jury selection, it's untimely. The law is clear. When you ask to represent yourself on the first day of trial, that's untimely. Moreover, the potential for a Feretta canvas, the district court's decision or determination of whether or not she was going to grant appellant's motion for self-representation being pushed to the second day, when you look at the record, is because that first day, in the first sealed hearing, it was clear that his problem, his issue, his concern was that he didn't feel like defense counsel had been providing him discovery. And the record is even further clear that it wasn't defense counsel that was failing to provide discovery, it was a jail policy. And defense counsel made clear that he had reviewed the discovery with the appellant multiple times, and it was continued to the second day of trial so that defense counsel could go and talk to him, go and review the discovery and see if they could communicate, and then they were readdressing the issues on the second day. When the matter came up again, when she asked, there was another sealed hearing, and it became clear in looking at the sealed hearing that appellant's issue wasn't with wanting to represent himself. It was with his views on what the evidence was, his problem with how he was taken into custody, how Metro got his DNA in the first place. And the court made a very thorough record. Specifically, this is an appellant's appendix 4, page 861 to 62, where she says the issue was not that he wanted to represent himself, but that he wanted defense counsel to basically sit as co-counsel, which, as appellant concedes and we all know, is not appropriate. So he said multiple times, I don't want to go to trial without representation. He wasn't unequivocal in that request. Moreover, I know defense counsel appellant, mentioned in argument that there was no indicia that he was going to be disruptive. There are multiple points in the record where he became emotional, where the state asked the court to admonish appellant on how to conduct himself in front of the jury, and the court said no because he hadn't had any kind of outbursts in front of the jury, which would have been its own separate issue. But it was such a concern outside the presence of the jury when he would get emotional, when he would become disruptive, where his focus was clearly his problem, his theory about how he had landed in court on trial for sex assaults that occurred back in the 90s. He thought Metro was framing him. He thought that that's what this whole situation was about. And it is in the record, specifically Appellant's Appendix 6, 1334 to 1335, where we made a record regarding a jail call that he said he wanted to put all of this on the record and everything that he was concerned about what Metro had done, and that if he testified, that's what he was going to do. It was those concerns that was surrounding the district court's determination on whether or not he was actually going to be disruptive. And she made a very clear record. She applied all of the standards. It was untimely. He was not unequivocal. And based on that, the court was valid in denying his motion for self-representation. Moving next to defendant's second argument on whether or not the state improperly commented on his right against self-incrimination. During direct examination of Detective Coker, questions were asked regarding, you read him his Miranda rights. He said yes. You asked if he knew Carlotta, the victim from 1994. He said no. You asked if he knew Teresa, the victim from 1996. He said no. Confirmed that he lived in Las Vegas. Confirmed that he lived in those areas. He agreed. She brought up, well, we need your DNA, because she let him know your DNA has come back on some sexual assault kits. This is in the preliminary hearing transcript. And his response was, that's impossible because I didn't rape anyone. She says, okay, well, we need your DNA. And at that point, he became uncooperative, and that came out at the district court in trial, but it was foundation. And when you look at Ramit, that's not what this is. Ramit says the state...
Why did they need the foundation for that at that point? So you get down to the... Then we told him we needed his DNA. And eventually his DNA was taken and he consented. What is the relevance other than consciousness of guilt to try to show, well, first he said no, but then he said yes? What's the point of the first he said no?
It was the point of the first time he said no was, quite frankly, it was foundational. And when you look at the arguments that we made in closing argument, it supports that, because at no point did the state argue that this was, in fact, evidence of guilt, because she was explaining, well, we need your DNA. He became uncooperative, and she said, well, we have a warrant.
But what is that foundation for, that there's not a danger of misuse? What is no offer to the state? For what purpose?
It's in
foundational for what?
Foundational for just explaining the story. In hindsight, was it essential? Perhaps not. But even under Ramit, you can look at this under a harmless error standard of evidence of just overwhelming evidence of guilt. This was not an ID case. This was a DNA case, an identity case.
Isn't a DNA case an identity case to some extent?
So before the district court, we did argue it was not an identity case. It was a DNA case. But you are right, Justice, that DNA and identity are the same thing. That was just a lot of the arguments regarding why we were presenting evidence the way it was. was because it was DNA. And at the end of the day, it's overwhelming evidence of guilt.
So your point is, even if it was maybe error to elicit that response, it's harmless in light of the whole record.
Yes, the state's position is it wasn't error and it doesn't qualify under Ramit because Ramit talks about refusal to consent to a warrantless search. And here there was a warrant, so Ramit is the state's position. It wouldn't even apply. However, if the court chose to look at this through the lens of Ramit, it's harmless because it was not mentioned at all during closing or rebuttal. And his DNA was in both sexual assault kits, 1.57 non-million, more likely to be him than anyone else. Turning next to their...
Can I just ask you...
Yes.
Getting to the issue on TH's remote testimony.
Yes.
Case-specific findings.
Absolutely. So there were appropriate case-specific findings when you look at this court's case in Lipsitz, as well as Newsom. The court made specific findings that COVID was a concern. Well, yes, this hearing happened when COVID was more of a concern than perhaps it was in 2022, August of 2022. That doesn't change the fact that COVID still, in fact, existed, that Teresa was over 50, which the CDC website, which appellant's brief cites, and if you actually look at the website, talks about, if you're over 50 years old, you are 25 times more likely to contract COVID. So she is in a protected group at that point.
I was over 65 at the time.
So the CDC said...
accused her of being 60. She was 51, right?
So the CDC website... If you're over 50, If you're over 50, according to the CDC, you're 25 times more likely to contract COVID. And if you were over, I believe, 65, you were, I want to say 95 times or whatever number is in their brief. I can't remember off the top of my head. I apologize. So while, yes, she's not in the super protected class, she still is in an at-risk population. And their argument for COVID isn't a valid reason, despite the record being very, very clear that she would have to get on a plane, that she would have to fly. This wasn't a simple let's drive down from California where I can quarantine in my room and wear a mask to court if I need to. She would have had to get on a plane. She would have to fly. And the argument that, well, if she caught COVID, there were treatments. It's just, that's, I mean, quite frankly, it's disrespectful of the fact that a woman is actually concerned about a very serious virus that shut down the world for years that at the time we still didn't know what was happening.
Your position is adequate record was made at the time to support the audio, the permission of the audiovisual.
Yes.
Just a side question on that. That was in 2021. Mm-hmm. The trial got continued and didn't happen until about a year later, September 2022.
Yes.
Was there any obligation on anyone to refresh that motion or relook at it?
The state's position is no, that the motion was still valid. If this court deems that someone should have raised it, the state's position is that should have been defense, and because they didn't, it's been waived and subject to plain error review. There was a substantial policy interest in allowing for the audiovisual testimony, and there were other indicia of reliability, otherwise assuring her testimony. We did not expect Teresa to identify the defendant. We wanted her to talk about what had happened, and then the DNA person was going to come in. And with that, we would respectfully request that you affirm his judgment of conviction. Thank you.
Ms. Barker. Mr. Waters, I'll give you an additional 2 minutes.
Thank you.
All right, Chief. 2 minutes?
Yes.
I'm sorry.
Thank you so much. Mr. Brown did not consent to his DNA. He was taken to the magistrate who allegedly issued the warrant, search warrant, and that magistrate explained to him, you have to give your DNA. Now, if that magistrate is wrong under North Carolina law, that does not turn into his like, I'll open my mouth and you can swab it. That does not turn into consent. North Carolina General Statute 15A247, a search warrant can only be executed by an officer whose investigative authority encompasses the crime or the crimes involved. State versus Rick. The officer has jurisdiction only if the essential acts forming the crime take place in North Carolina. Nothing in this case happened in North Carolina other than his arrest. But the crime, the alleged sexual assaults, occurred wholly in Nevada. Now, regarding his motion for self-representation, his concerns about his counsel are immaterial. He has a right to say, I think he's the greatest attorney in the world, but it doesn't matter. I just want to represent myself. So the court engages in this talking him out of it, sort of suggesting he really should have counsel. Why don't you meet with him? What does it matter? He made a unequivocal request. I would like to represent myself. At that point, I think this court has recognized under Miles the obligation to at least do the canvas and see if he can pass the canvas. Look, if he didn't pass the canvas, we're not even, this is a non-issue. Conduct the canvas would be my advice to the district court. Whether his defense was I was framed or what is that? So what? That's a valid defense. If he has evidence that would suggest that that's actually what happened, who cares? Then he can assert that defense. People are framed. I'm not saying it happens every day, but it does happen from time to time. So the fact that he makes a phone call and he says I was framed somehow suggests that like he's not capable of representing himself because that would lead to disruption. Disruption is, you know, the jury's in the room. He stands up and starts screaming and yelling. That's disruption. Disruption is, you know, like you see with these sovereign citizen guys, like, you know, the flag has a fringe, so you have no jurisdiction over me. There's no indication that Mr. Brown was going to assert any of those goofy arguments. His argument was I was framed. That's a legitimate defense to the allegations here. With respect to the I know Your Honor is very aware of Newsom because that was my appeal and Your Honor was on that panel. So I remember flying up to Carson City to argue this. Here's the problem. Number one, the state makes the motion for remote testimony. The motion basically says nothing about her previous pre-existing conditions. It says she's in that class of people. They don't say what her age is, any of that. She's terrified to come to Las Vegas. Okay, look, in 2021, at August of 2021, vaccines were available for everyone. She's unvaccinated. I'm sympathetic if she had a contraindication. That's fine. Like, and that might be an important reason why the court would say, you know what? She can't get vaccinated, so we're not going to force her to come out here. But there's no record. And, you know, they're the moving party. And so they have to say, look, there's a reason why she's not vaccinated. If it was just, I don't feel like getting vaccinated, well, you know, like, that's your choice. And I respect that. That doesn't mean you get to violate his right to confrontation. 2021, we were in a much different COVID landscape. Vaccines, treatments, so forth. In 2022, when the trial actually began, every COVID mitigation had been rescinded by both the governor and the district court. So the idea that she deserves special treatment because of some irrational fear of COVID.
You should have raised that.
So my position is this: the moving party has an obligation when they are seeking the court to do something, when circumstances change, to readdress them. And this was a huge change in circumstances. Mr. Brown is entitled to suspect, like, given changed circumstances, that motion's kind of moot because it was based on a very specific date.
Mr. Waters, let me ask you a question. Even if we were to credit your argument that perhaps it was improvidently permitted, the fact of sexual assault was not contested. This witness did not identify, was not there pointing out the client, in fact, couldn't. You know, that wasn't part of it. How would we evaluate the prejudice of letting that testimony proceed remotely?
So, fair question. This is a case that occurred 20 years prior. You know, I don't know what I mean, I know generally what I was doing 20 years ago, but I don't know specifics about a specific date or time. She did not, contrary to what the prosecutor stated, TH did not identify him. CD identified him. So that's the wrong witness. TH never identified him. That's the guy that did it. So you have a situation where there is DNA, but the mere fact that DNA is present and she's claiming I was sexually assaulted doesn't mean that his DNA couldn't have been there earlier, couldn't have been the result of a consensual sexual encounter. And so the problem is she gets to testify remotely and cry and talk about how damaging this was to her life. And Mr. Brown doesn't get, I concede that it's a tough road given the current case law. I understand that. But we're talking about the fundamental right to confrontation, and we're talking about it in the context of U.S. Supreme Court has routinely recognized how fundamental this is. It's face-to-face confrontation. A lot can happen when that person is in the room that may not happen when they're on a video screen thousands of miles away.
If the defendant was not challenging the sexual assault, and I don't, my recollection of the record is that, I was going to say, can I continue? But I'm going to keep on. And that was my recollection is that that was not, it was, hey, she's assaulted. She was, somebody assaulted her, but not me.
Right.
right? And she didn't have any epiphany during her testimony and actually point him out, now I remember, that's the person. So those two things make it a little bit, the context a little bit different than in some other confrontation violations. The question is just on fair, the scale, how would we deal with that?
Your Honor, it's a fair point. And, you know, it's tough. I don't want to concede anything, certainly. But I understand your concerns, and I understand, like, the problematic nature of, like, what I'm trying to argue. I get that. I would just go back to the fact that there's something different about being present in the courtroom versus, and you never know. And he did contest the sexual assault in this sense. I didn't do it, but just as a point of clarification. But, right, he didn't say, like, she was never sexually assaulted. That's true, by anyone else. I just think that given the fundamental right involved, given the dynamic nature of trial, and given that things change when you're in the room, I think that, you know, that tips the balance in his favor. But I do recognize this court's precedent on that issue.
All right. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you so much.
All right, counsel. In this case.